Hello there, it's Jim here with another Outbreak Capercast. Glad to have you listening. This time I'm going to, again, dive into some recordings that I made last summer up in Maine, sitting around in the Stern Castle with my old friend Larry Fortunoff. We were tied to a dock at a place called Buck's Harbor, Deer Isle, Maine, in his Marple's 40-foot trimaran that he's owned and sailed a long time and a long way. I have to do a fair bit of editing to these capers because otherwise it's just the noise of doing dishes and profanity. But when the weather is settled and you're not worried about dragging anchor, I think these Stern Castle or cockpit conversations are really a big part of the essence of cruising. It was great fun for us then. It's fun for me to listen to it now, and we hope it is for you too. We start out talking about Woody Brown, then get carried away about the hybrid wing and come back to Woody in the end. Here we go.
Years later, you recontacted him. Did he remember you? And
No, he didn't remember.
He didn't remember you. So how did you like reintroduce yourself to him?
I told him that he had given me my first ride in a multi-hull.
Uh-huh.
And it was like, oh, boy, we did that for a lot of people.
You know? Right, because how many people can he remember, that, right, you know, especially you?
Yeah.
You know, all the trips that he made out.
Yeah.
And who knows what he was like, you know, drinking or sniffing or smoking at the time. Who
knows?
Because see how being who he was, I don't think he was a straight man.
Absolutely straight.
Absolutely straight.
Absolutely. I get the... From what I know about him, you know, he was not only a teetotaler, but he said, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I want to take care of this beautiful body.
Well, 96. Yeah. I guess he did.
Yeah. That was when he was 92.
All right, well, anyway.
He lived 2 years longer.
Getting back, so you reconnected with him. He didn't really remember you, but you told him you had gone out sailing with him early on, how many years before.
Yeah.
And you must have said, hey, you know, is that when you went out to interview him with Barry Choi and all that? Was that when you reconnected with him?
Yeah, well, Barry Choi was with us that day, but we were in two boats.
Okay.
And so we had to hop back and forth from one boat to the other in places,
right,
in order to get Scott with his cameras to be able to shoot one boat from the other,
right,
both ways, you know.
Now, did Barry Choi know? I guess Barry Choi knew you by then, right?
I mean, yeah, I had known Barry since he was a teenager.
How'd that happen?
He was the guitarist, the lead guitarist in a little combo that was featured as live music every night on board of one of Rudy Choi's 80-foot dinner cruise charter boats.
Out of
Honolulu, along Waikiki as the sun sets.
Okay, you know? So now we got to stop now. How did you like know about Rudy Choi now? I mean...
Oh, oh, God, this is too much. This is very circuitous logic here.
Well, we might as well, like, investigate it.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Let's see. I had met Rudy Choi in Big Sur, California, in about 1961 or two.
Mm-hmm.
And Don McQueen were building, Don McQueen and I were building the first Piver 40, the Victorist.
Okay.
Down there in the Big Sur Valley. The highway had originally been built by the CCC boys during the Depression.
Yeah.
And the stonework along portions of the highway is elegant, just wonderful. And the stories of the CCC boys in Big Sur go on and on, but the one I like the best is that these stonemasons that were carving these blocks of beautiful red granite that were right out of the mountainside all around them, you know,
uh-huh, leftover slag from trying to, you know, using steam shovels and stuff to cut a scratch in the mountainside. And so Gretchen was up there in the bow of the boat. We had a rare sunny day where the sun was shining.
Wait, is it down. Now? This is the Vitress, the Piver boat.
Victress.
Yeah. That you're building. Yeah. And she's up on the bow of the boat.
So she went out there and climbed into the boat for a little sun bath, and she sort of stripped down and snuggled up into the bow of the boat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she had the sun bearing down on her, and it was like, oh boy, this is great, you know. And then she heard outside, hey, Marge, Pete, Louie, look at this.
Now I know why you won't have it before.
Yeah, it's a catamaran, you idiot.
That's a beauty. Oh, God.
And then they came up to the bow, and they're rubbing their hands on the fiberglass plywood bow, you know. And she was right inside, and it was like they were rubbing her body. And she was, oh, God. She tried to be quiet. She finally screamed at him.
What are you doing?
Yeah, we had a lot of people interrupt our work down there.
Well, you know, that's how it is, you know. Yeah. Especially they don't even know what the hell you're doing, basically. Right. But it's something. Thing? What is that? But then
something.
Again, you got to remember that it's like, you know, like you were like space aliens or something, you know, like where you landed on a and it was, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, you know, like were you like really humans or you were aliens? What are you building? You know, nobody had seen a big trimaran like that. It wasn't, you know, like in the comics or something,
right?
Well, of course, I never got back to meeting Rudy Choi. That's where it happened. He stopped by the boat one day when we were building it down there, and we had a good gab and later got to know each other very well out in Hawaii. Rudy was a gifted designer and a vocal proponent of the catamaran and a real gentleman. And perhaps more than anyone, Rudy took a lot of water off of the traditional yachting community because his boats were beautiful. They were the first really professionally built, great-looking, multi-hull seafaring yachts, and as such were quite threatening to the yachting establishment. And they were after him all the time, you know. They denied him races and stuff. And anyway, he finally wrote a book, I think it was called Catamaran Ocean Racing, and one of the best early books about multi-hulls. Well, here we go on another tangent now. Larry and I are talking about the hybrid wing.
So, okay, somebody told me just the other day that there's a difference between what's at the bottom of, you know, the foot of the wing as opposed to the wind that's up on the top of the wing.
Great difference. It turns out it's almost 30 degrees.
30 degrees. Now, could you draw that out for me?
Because that's that. Well, when you see these race boats sailing with their main booms hauled in almost dead nuts
right,
and midships,
there is like this.
And then they've got twist off at the
twist
top.
Twist off at the top. Yeah. And that twist off is the top because the wind is different at the top?
The wind direction and velocity are different at the top. It's not just that their direction and velocity differ. It's that because of the greater velocity, it's a greater vector on the boat.
Uh-huh.
Because it's that old, you know, pulling the apparent thing.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
so Randy Smythe knows all about that, though.
Yeah, and that's and he certainly does. And what he's got in this hybrid wing is something that is, I think, as efficient or more efficient than the rigid wing sails on the America's Cup boats, which contain four elements.
Now, why is that? Why do you think that is?
The main element on these America's Cup boats has on its trailing edge three
panels or something, right?
Ailerons.
Ailerons, right.
And those all have to be trimmed
to account for the difference in the wind direction and velocity between the surface and at the top of the mast.
Uh-huh.
That's why big boats can reach up and really grab the air.
But how do they get a twist with an aeroline? I mean, it seems like
that's it. They can't.
They can't, right?
But Randy Smythe, who is a sail designer,
right? He understands.
He made a sail to fit this wing that gives the whole wing while it's in service, really with the air flowing over it. It's like the water flowing over a propeller blade.
Are you explaining this in your article?
No. I haven't really thought of it in these terms, Larry.
Yeah.
But what he's really put up there in the wind is more like a propeller blade.
Come on.
Yeah.
How so?
Because a propeller blade has a twist in it.
Right.
Because the tip speed is so much greater.
That's right. Yeah.
It's that twist. They're trying to devise a rig that looks like it grew that way to do that job.
But what about the other tack, you know? How does it go for the other tack to twist around?
It twists around. The first about 35 or 40% of the foil is rigid. The backside, the downwind side of the wind coming off of the rigid onto the soft element is a dead nuts, almost polished steel surface all the way to the trailing edge of this combination of these wings. And as you look up at the photographs that Scott took,
right,
you can see that the soft sail is trimmed a little soft at the top.
Uh-huh.
And at the bottom, it's over-trimmed. And if you look up through the belly of the whole thing, between the rigid portion and the the soft element, it looks like you're inside the hub and looking out of a propeller blade.
No. Really?
Yeah.
You can see that kind of twist.
Yeah.
Wow. But...
And you can see from both sides.
And it's because
it's photographs. You see from both sides.
Both sides.
Yeah, yeah. All you have to do is then duck under the sail. You're out there in this trampoline. You're going over the water at 30 knots.
So that, I think that's like really a breakthrough right there, in a way.
Absolutely. That's why I think these guys are onto something that has historical significance.
Right. Because if you can get that kind of action at the top and the bottom of this solid wing sail with a hybrid, nobody else has got that done, really, yet. I don't think so.
No, and not only can you get that, but you can get away from that. That is, you have one reef point, and in the soft portion, you can pull the soft portion down to looks like about 63% or something.
But do you lose that twist? You must lose that twist then.
Now... You trim the rigid portion of the foil so that in that portion that protrudes above the soft sail,
right,
which has a square head sticking out the side of it two-thirds of the way up, okay, from there on up, the wing is trimmed.
Right.
To the point where it is overcoming heeling effort on the boat.
Uh-huh.
And in the lower portion... of the propeller blade.
You're getting power.
They've got enough power to make that happen.
Wow. That's cool. That's very cool.
I mean, that's historical.
It is historical.
And then if it becomes too heavy for that, you get the soft sail down altogether, or else if the wind is coming up hard from astern, and you want to be able to let the rigid portion of the wing feather to however far you want to let it feather,
So you've
got to get the soft sail off.
Right.
Got to be able to turn the wing loose from the soft sail.
Now, I thought it was like a square top, but it was a square top.
And the square top goes all the way to the head.
But you can't. How could you do 360? You can't. Okay, it's only
Can't unless you start the reef.
Right.
You know, and as a matter of fact, unless you get the soft sail down all the way, you can't really trim it off for a hard wind coming from astern.
Okay.
But if you get there, if you can trim it off for a hard wind from astern, now you're in complete control.
Right.
You can put power on the boat. It's got a certain amount of drag up there. It's blowing like hell, but it probably has less drag than other rigs.
Right.
And
it's more controllable.
And you can control it with one hand.
And if the wind, if the squall passes through, pull them on in, you know?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There's gray areas in there that I don't understand. I don't suppose I do yet either. But Randy Smythe's one of the greatest sailors in the world.
Right.
And when he came in surprised that the thing was a tool for seamanship.
Uh-huh. It is something to be excited because it is amazing. You're like, it's almost like a discovery of how do rockets fly or something. You know, oh God, if we just have like this kind of, you know, a couple of these tubes and, you know, like the right chemicals that we can burn it out and, you know, get it out like through these like little cones at the bottom and shit, we can get altitude this way. This is the same kind of thing. I mean, it's like a breakthrough of of propulsion and power.
I think so too.
So
far.
With wind.
It's not necessarily more efficient than a four-element rigid wing.
Right.
But it's practical.
It's so much practical.
Yeah.
That's.
And it may even be more efficient because it trims itself automatically compared to in the rigid elements field, the guy has to trim each each aileron independently.
Anyway, you described it as like the shape of a feather.
In profile. Mm-hmm.
Two feathers together.
Yes. One out of the starboard wing of the giant bird, and the other out of the port wing
of the giant bird.
And you bring them around and grow them together around the edges with a big fat hollow between.
Uh-huh.
That's the shape of that thing.
Here it's almost like you've got this thing at your fingertips that's generating almost as much power as a steam engine, when you think about it. And you could, like, stop the power of it by just, like, you know, letting it cock to the wind.
It puts it in neutral.
In neutral, that just... it's pretty breakthrough-ish.
Hey, excuse me. I must interrupt again. When Larry and I were talking that night, I had an idea, and I'm afraid if I don't put it in here, I'll forget it. I've always felt that this hybrid wing stuff really had a strong reference to hydrofoils at the same time. The two really go together. If wing sails really become practical, and they're on the brink of being there, I think, they suggest that hydrofoils too may become practical. Of course, hydrofoil motorboats are practical now, but sailing hydrofoils are something else. And there's a couple of things here. Sailing hydrofoils require a whole lot of power in order to get the vessel to climb up out of the water and fly over the surface on its foils. It's that whole takeoff window thing. And because the wings are so powerful, I think they will affect the takeoff window to real advantage. And I've said before that I think of the real property of the hydrofoil vessel is not necessarily its speed. Of course, speed is important, but I think more important is this riding motion. And it'll be a while before this automatic flight control becomes really mature. That is, an electronic means of talking to the control surfaces on the lifting hydrofoils in order to smooth out the ride. Right now, they're more concerned with just trying to get the automatic flight control to maintain a given elevation of the boat above the surface of the sea. But I think it's inevitable that hydrofoil automatic flight control for foilers is going to involve LISAR, that laser radar technology that's being developed particularly for self-driving automobiles. It's radar beams that reach out from the vehicle in order to read what's going on around it. And there's no reason in my mind that that can't be adopted to seafaring, wherein the Lysar beams looking out forward and to the side and even behind of a fast-moving hydrofoil sailboat, commercial operation now. We're not necessarily talking about recreation. This is a pretty serious commercial consideration for the future. I can see the Lysar beams talking to the computer and the computer talking to the control surfaces on the foils so as to allow the vessel to fly a little higher above the surface of the water in the troughs and a little lower closer to the crests, so that in most normal seafaring conditions you could really smooth out the ride. And I can see the algorithm even being capable of performing what a downhill skier would call pre-jumping. If you're really flying down the mountain on skis and there's a big hump in front of you, you don't want to let the hump throw you up, make you fly through the air. That takes your skis off of the snow, and for however far you fly with no skis on the snow, you're out of control. You're just soaring through the air. You can't turn, you can't brake, you can't do anything. And it would be the same thing with hydrofoil boats, of course. If the boat leaps over a wave high enough to lift the foils, the lifting part of the foils out of the water, the boat's out of control. Now, with luck, it'll come back down and establish control, get the foils and the control surfaces back in the water. But to avoid that soaring through the air of leaping off of the lumps, the downhill skier tries to develop his skill at pre-jumping. And so, as you're approaching this hump, you go into a crouch and then jump before you get to the lip, so that you're just barely kissing the snow going over the lip, and as you drop down over the backside, you got your skis on the snow very much sooner than if you had allowed the jump in front of you to throw you up in the air and make you fly for a while. So I had that idea while I was talking with Larry that night, but it all came out gobbledygook, and so I figured I better cut it out and explain it now in plain English. I'm just saying that if hydrofoil vessels ever fully develop the automatic flight control, I think it'll be a system that's capable of pre-jumping and really straightening out the ride in normal conditions, and then when a big wave comes, pre-jump it in order to keep from being, you know, taking off like a rocket on the crest of the wave. And of course, it's flat-out conjecture, but if it ever happens, remember you heard about it first here on Jim Brown's Outrigged Capercast. Okay, at this point, Larry and I got back into talking about Woody Brown, where it all started. We even started pulling up the promos for some videos that have been made featuring Woody over the years, and we ended up having a lot of fun laughing at it. Things were getting kind of boozy by now, but they're talking about surfing here, and of course, Woody was one of the first big wave surfers. And the lifestyle commitment of these people talking about surfing for life is much like what happens to us with multi-hulls.
All right, what do we got to do? They're only about a minute and a half long each.
Yeah.
This one's 3 minutes.
I think this is what puts surfing ahead of all other sports, is the environment that you're in. I mean, you're sitting out in the water, and you're looking at a coastline that's 69. Beautiful. You're looking at these faces of waves coming in, and you're just a part of that ocean.
Peter Cole, another big wave pioneer, was born in Santa Monica near the famous Malibu Beach. As a student at Stanford, he met Fred Van Dyke and began a lifelong friendship based on a love of surfing.
It's just when the surf's good, you just got to cancel the social gatherings. You got to forget about the party, and you got to forget about the wedding that we were going to go to, and this and that and that. I mean, the surf's up.
I went into teaching because I like kids, first of all, but I also liked the vacation time. I could go surfing when I wanted, you know, and that was the most important thing.
Fred became a teacher in California, then moved to Hawaii, where he joined the faculty of the esteemed Punahou School. He immediately began urging his close friend, Peter Cole, to join him in the islands.
Fred kept writing me, I've got to come to Punahou, I've got to come to Punahou. That's what ruined me. I became a surf addict.
Yeah, I know, but who were you trying to kid that you weren't a fanatic? I mean, you were more fanatic than I ever was. I looked up to you. I followed you. All the things I got in trouble about were because you taught
me. Oh, no, no. I was a good example. These students build up these rumors, like we ditched classes and we did this and we did that just to surf. We never did.
Yes, we did.
Never ditched a class.
You're getting sent out.
Totally responsible. But we never did that.
We did.
This is rumored between these two guys. Laughing.
I hear this folklore about how every time the surf was up, the teachers were not there, but that was exaggerated.
They got,
I can't speak for Fred, but I was relatively dedicated. You know, I would work a trade with another teacher that taught the same subject I did. And the only bad thing was these mandatory meetings that we would have to go to. And every time we had a mandatory meeting, the surf would get good.
You're supposed to make a presentation at a meeting in the afternoon, and Peter Cole calls me up and says, 25 feet at Waimea, you find a way to get out of the meeting. I mean, the meeting is secondary. Everything is secondary.
I'd have to go in there and he's, why didn't you make the mandatory meeting? And I would be honest. I said, well, the surf was good. And I felt that the surf was more important for my mental health than the meeting, you know.
We have a schedule change that I need to tell you
about. I would call my secretary and say, Gail, I'm going to a board meeting. And that was the signal that I was going to be a little late, and she knew where I was.
A lot of people think of us as being a little weird just because we're doing something that's fun, and I'm doing it all I can, and it's just a little abnormal for most people to think that anybody would be doing that.
Abnormal.
Surfers generally are nonconformists. And a lot of good ideas and creativity comes from a non-conforming person.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah. That's great.
For me, growing up in Hawaii and my grandfather being who he is, it always amazed me, especially when I was younger and I was at parties. All I had to do was mention Woody Brown, and I was like, whoa! There was a crowd surrounding me. Even today, young kids still know who Woody Brown is.
Woody Brown represented this kind of imaginative, you know, grandeur of, you know, men going out and challenging the sea and no one being around and surviving and coming back.
In Woody's time, he was a pioneer into a realm that had not been previously experienced by man.
Well, the same thing was true with the early multi-hulls, that we were going surfing with our families in our family home.
He was a hell of a sailor, he was a hell of a surfer, and obviously a hell of a glider. I think it was the biggest wave and the hardest challenge was good enough for him.
The answer is this. If you work with nature instead of against nature, you can do things that no other man can do.
Woody, he's like a, yeah.
Oh yeah, all right. That was fun. Hope it was for you. I got a little something different next time. Hope you come back. Bye-bye.